From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Increasingly, the world watches the protest called Occupy Wall Street, now finishing its third week, camping out in Lower Manhattan. Recent clashes in which police pepper sprayed and beat protesters with batons drew even the most resistant media outlets.
Each new depiction of the abuses of the police on the First Amendment, the more waves of occupation will spread across this country.
Yeah.
And you should be proud of that, police, because you are participating in our media publicity campaign.
Some Occupy Wall Street advocates complained about what they called a news blackout in its early weeks. But in fact, this progressive populist protest did better than its anti-government analog, the Tea Party. According to the Pew Research Center, the Wall Street protests made up 1.6% of the overall news whole in the week of September 26 to October 2nd. The first Tea Party protests in February 2009 received no measurable coverage. True, much of the Occupy Wall Street coverage has been dismissive or worse, but the Tea Party condemned its coverage too. Soon, of course, the Tea Party scored pots of conservative money and a house organ in Fox News. For now, Occupy Wall Street, which calls for economic justice for the vulnerable but offers no specifics, no demands, and no candidates, is on its own. Thursday was sunny and fine, and Foley Square was full of people, many looking like they'd slept there, which they had. There was food, lots of cameras, the curious and the committed, the latter with signs condemning the 1% of Americans whose grip on wealth and power makes life so hard for the other 99%. The mood was good. Bill Dobbs was sitting at a tiny table with a handwritten sign saying press, so people like me would have someone to talk to. He had worked with the AIDS activist group ACT UP years ago.
We're down here giving off a loud outcry in the shadow of Wall Street. It has now sparked other similar protests in other cities around the country. That's very important.
How does it translate into action? Something more than just a kind of pre-decor without any focus.
It's a very clear focus when you say Occupy Wall Street.
You think?
Let me put it in this way. Easily 150, 200 or more outlets have sent staff down here to do stories, sometimes freelancers. When I look online at the leads, they've framed the issue, often revolving around economics. And I think there's a problem in people hammering and demanding that there be a slogan or a list of things that people want, because it's a huge project just to get attention, and that's happened. Wall Street's not going to get reformed overnight, nor is Congress, but there's anger and despair that's brought people down here. There's also camaraderie, community, and fun. And those are the two ingredients that have enabled this protest to sustain itself against the NYPD and the weather for almost 3 weeks now. You wouldn't be down here if there wasn't some buzz around this.
There are a number of people who say the attention really riveted on this place when the cops pepper sprayed people, corralled people, and so on. And then suddenly people were noticing what was going on in Wall Street in a way that they had not before.
Part of this protest is media production. Dozens of people out with video cameras, coordinating that, uploading it, live streaming. That's how the police misconduct came to light. So we have one working group that's dealing extensively with creating media to project what people are doing here, and some of us are working with media outlets to get the message through. There have been columns and there have been editorials which have said, you might not agree with the way that people on this plaza are crying out, but the issues that are being raised could not be more important. It's been a slow build.
What's next? Do you have a plan?
Right now, the plan is to be here indefinitely and to do everything possible to bring more people into it. People come in all the time. They want to know what's going on. There was a sign one day on the plaza that said, if you make less than $250,000, you should join us. Why? Because everybody's hanging by a thread. And that's also true of members of the media. You know, recall a broadcast producer coming through here. He was very grumpy, and he said, I'm really mad because I wanted to cover something else, and my boss assigned me to cover self-indulgent college students. I said, if I may, how's your pension? He said, I don't have one. I said, you know, that's part of the reason people are here.
Some protests fizzle, some become movements, the result of an unpredictable alchemy of character, issue, tactics, and timing. Michael Kazin teaches history at Georgetown University and is the author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. Does he see movement potential in Occupy Wall Street?
For it to become a movement, it has to become organized, it has to have recognizable spokespeople, it has to have a strategy and not just a set of protest tactics. So this may or may not become one, but right now it is a protest campaign.
It's often been likened to the Tea Party, which was often mischaracterized as being purely AstroTurf, the child of a lot of well-heeled conservative activists. I mean, it was that, but it wasn't only that.
No, I think the Tea Party was and is quite sincere grassroots insurgency. It's really the creature of 30, 40 years of conservative organizing on these issues. The rage of the Tea Party bubbled up partly because of the financial crisis, the idea that big banks were being bailed out by the government, and also a frustration with their own conservative president, George W. Bush.
So what do you think Occupy Wall Street needs in order to become a movement?
It needs to last longer, of course, get alliances, not just with some labor unions, but with perhaps immigrant groups, perhaps with some people in the left-wing of the Democratic Party. It needs to do what the Civil Rights Movement did, what the anti-war movement did in the 1960s, what the labor movement did in the 1930s, which is to appear to be the voice of people who have not really had a voice about their discontent, their anger with what's happened to the American economy. What we're seeing, I think, between Tea Party people and the Wall Street protesters is a battle to define who's to blame for our economic calamity, who's to blame for the lack of jobs, who's to blame for the political system not really responding.
I think that the Occupy Wall Street protest has undergone a transition of some kind in the last week, that somehow it's crossed over into being taken seriously.
Oh, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Why is that? It's almost conventional wisdom. They can't go anywhere without goals. They can't go anywhere without organization. They can't go anywhere without clear demands and party affiliations. They actively resist these things. They want to move ahead in an inchoate fashion as an expression of discontent.
Well, I think at this stage, being a little inchoate, being a little incoherent even, but being very clear what you're against more than what you're for, enables lots of people to take part with their own reasons. But after a while, when we're getting into November and December in the Northeast, clearly people aren't going to continue to camp out in large numbers. So at this stage, what they're doing is very effective. If it continues to go on, people in the media will say, well, you did this for 2 months. What are you going to do next?
But I'm still puzzled. Why are they even effective now?
Well, partly, talk about the media, I think there's been a sense that with this economic discontent, not just here, but elsewhere in the world, that why aren't Americans angry about this? Why are the only Americans angry about the government? So I think for very good reasons, a lot of people in the media have been looking for this to happen for some time. And once it starts to happen, they cover it, and the coverage itself helps to generate more interest.
The Vancouver-based anti-consumerist magazine Adbusters kicked this whole thing off with a call to Occupy Wall Street last summer. Its co-founder told Salon that Adbusters was a student of the Situationist movement. This is the idea that if you have a very powerful meme, an idea, and the moment is ripe, then that is in itself enough to ignite a revolution.
Well, the Situationists did not ignite a revolution. They did ignite a very powerful movement that was pretty short-lived in France and a few other countries. And they were influential to a certain degree among some new left intellectuals in this country as well. The fact that most people in your listening audience have never heard of them itself, I think, is an indication that their influence was interesting, but not highly significant, I don't think. One thing they did make clear, and this was certainly happening in the 60s with people like Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, the Yippies, is that they realized that if you can be humorous and provocative and make the powers that be look small, look ridiculous, you can really get people on your side.
I guess I subscribe, to my own surprise, to a kind of ether theory of movements in that, you know, in the Tea Party, you had all of this anger going into the ether. It didn't really matter whether the facts were right or wrong. There was a kind of change in the temperature, and suddenly these ideas were everywhere, just filling the air. It strikes me that this is an attempt to change the temperature again, to change how people see the world.
As a historian, I think that nothing comes from nothing, and it's still, in numbers, fairly small. That has to be said. But then, of course, the four people who sat in at lunch counters in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1960 was also a small group, but they were representing a larger group. So size itself isn't enough. But I think people in the media are groping to sort of understand who these people are, whether they are really on the left or whether they are just a group of fairly non-ideological people. All these questions seem to be open.
Do you have any notion of which way you think this could go?
This is fun about being a historian. You know, these things are not predictable. They really have to keep adapting to changes in the structures that they are protesting. People make their own history, but not as they please, as this famous leftist Karl Marx wrote in the 19th century.
Michael, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Michael Kazin's new book is American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, offering local seminars that provide tools for marketing small businesses. Details at ConstantContact.com/local. The Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to improve Americans' understanding of Muslim arts and cultures, and the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last Friday in Yemen, a U.S. drone strike killed two al-Qaeda targets, Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan. The two were both unique figures in al-Qaeda. First, they were both Americans. Secondly, their command of English meant they could communicate directly with would-be radicals in the West. Khan was reportedly the editor of Inspire, the al-Qaeda English language magazine. Al-Awlaki worked in front of the camera through internet sermons the government believed were designed to inspire militancy among Muslims here at home. Jared Brockman is the author of Global Jihadism, Theory and Practice, and has closely followed the way that al-Awlaki and Khan have gotten their message to the West. Jarrett, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks.
Are the deaths of these men a big blow to al-Qaeda?
It's devastating. I mean, al-Awlaki and Samir Khan had revolutionized the way that al-Qaeda was able to reach out and touch the West. And there's really nobody left on the bench that has what's taken those two decades of work to develop. For a long time, a lot of kids in the West who supported al-Qaeda still felt like they were playing second fiddle to their Arabic counterparts. They didn't have a lot of access or forums that they could kind of spout off in, and they weren't really valued within the al-Qaeda global movement. Al-Awlaki and Samir Khan changed all that.
And what are they credited with achieving?
They were able to inspire and direct numerous attacks. We have direct email correspondence between al-Awlaki and Nidal Hassan, the alleged Fort Hood shooter. We have cases of, say, an individual who just watched al-Awlaki's videos and took it upon herself to go out and stab a British member of parliament. We have directed attacks that al-Awlaki was clearly involved with Omar Farouk Abdelmutallab, the alleged underwear bomber, and numerous other examples of those kinds of, you know, operational strikes.
They came to these roles through very different paths. Tell me how they got to be where they got to be.
Samir Khan saw himself as kind of a pseudo-intellectual. He developed kind of his propaganda skill set working out of his parents' home in Charlotte, North Carolina. For years, he was just posting online to these Islamic forums, and soon posting wasn't good enough, so he started his own blog. That wasn't good enough, so he started his own pro-Al-Qaeda media outlet here in the United States. That wasn't good enough, so he started making videos, and eventually he made his own English-language pro-Al-Qaeda magazine. You know, Samir Khan knew what it was like to be one of these kids who wanted to support Al-Qaeda, couldn't do it, and took it upon himself to change how the game was played.
Tell me about Al-Awlaki. How did he get to be sort of the Tokyo Rose of militant Islam?
You know, if you go back and listen to a lot of his sermons, virtually none of them have anything to do with violence, or at least openly espouse violence. What he does is provide a very distilled, back-to-basics understanding of Islam.
Often, these sermons were in no way incendiary. Let's just listen to him talking about obesity.
Umar ibn Khattab would encourage exercise, and he didn't like obesity. In fact, he said, beware of overeating. If you are overweight, even if it's caused by genetic reasons, try to lose weight.
I should make it clear that while sometimes he was talking about obesity, a recurring theme was that Islam is under attack. Did he ever, though, issue orders, say you must act, you must defend Islam?
No, the way Al-Awlaki would do this is he would let you do the math. He would present you with the problem. He'd say, you're under attack. Islam is under attack. You have at your disposal an arsenal of tools you can employ. What are you going to do? Are you going to live up to your duty? Or are you going to sit back and let Islam be conquered? So people would feel more invested because they came to the conclusion themselves. He wasn't giving these command statements like Zawahiri bin Laden, shaking his finger at people saying, you must do this. Because for his constituency, a lot of them hadn't bought off on the idea. A lot of them didn't support Al-Qaeda, or at least weren't sure if they could. And so Al-Awlaki brought a lot of fence-sitters who otherwise may not have been interested in the Al-Qaeda ideology over with him when he joined up. So I think this opens a massive chasm that will be almost impossible for Al-Qaeda to fill.
Well, that's an optimistic view. Others are less optimistic. What's the argument that says that these roles will be filled rapidly by others?
I mean, I think the biggest counterargument is that the genie's already out of the bottle, right? That Al-Awlaki's already flooded the internet with his sermons. Khan has already produced now 7 Inspire magazines plus a whole backlog of his previous magazine. And so the movement itself will fill that role. In many ways, you know, I make that argument myself, but I think in the absence of having a rallying figure like Al-Awlaki, it will quickly dissipate in terms of the coherence and lethality of that movement.
Is there a precedent for targeting not just American citizens, but propagandists as opposed to guys with their fingers on triggers?
It's a complicated question because not a lot of open source information has been released about the role that Al-Awlaki played operationally. So I think this is why you see the Obama administration calling him the chief of external operations as opposed to focusing on his propaganda role. By saying he was the main target, they kind of get themselves out of that question. Samir Khan, however, it seems to me, was purely a propagandist. I think that's why the Obama administration is saying his death wasn't the focus, he just happened to be in the vehicle. This administration has showed that it's willing to take these kind of unprecedented steps in order to take out unprecedented individuals.
Jared, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Jared Brockman is the author of Global Jihadism, Theory and Practice. For years, healthcare reporters looking for information on medical malpractice payouts and disciplinary cases have used a government database called the National Practitioner Data Bank. It's primarily used by healthcare institutions, but a public version is available with physicians' names replaced by an alphanumeric code, making them anonymous. Nevertheless, by overlaying other records obtained through old-fashioned digging, journalists have been able to pair incidents from the database with actual doctors, and the reporting has been eye-opening. But last month, in response to complaints from at least one physician databased into infamy, the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA, took the public version of this database offline. Charles Ornstein, a director for ProPublica and president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists, has partnered with the Society of Professional Journalists and Investigative Reporters and Editors to condemn this action in an open letter to the White House. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. Great to be here.
Let's start with the case that really brought this issue to a head. It was a story reported in the Kansas City Star.
Reporter Alan Bavley of the Star was looking into a situation involving a doctor there who had been accused of malpractice a number of times. And he was able to use the National Practitioner Data Bank in order to determine just how many cases he had involving his license. The physician had his lawyer call up the Health Resources and Services Administration to complain that Bavley had taken this out of the National Practitioner Data Bank, when in fact, given the research he had done on the doctor already, he knew who the doctor was, but the database was able to provide additional information.
There have been several stories elsewhere in which reporters depended on the practitioner data bank to get to the bottom of who was creating a trail of malpractice without being sanctioned by their state and local medical boards.
No question. I mean, here you have a data bank, and you can directly say that it enabled reporters across the country to write stories that expose serious problems with patient care and patient safety. And many of these stories led to new laws being passed, increased transparency to the public of malpractice suits against doctors, a greater attention by medical boards to overseeing doctors. So these reporters had a direct hand in making patient care safer in their states, which is why it's all the more troubling that this resource is now not available anymore.
So what happens next, at least in the Missouri case, is the lawyer for the doctor who was at the center of the story said this National Practitioner Data Bank is being misused by journalists, so you got to take this thing down. And the Obama administration said, okay.
Right. I mean, what's so frustrating is this is one complaint by one doctor's lawyer, and the administration responds by taking the entire file down. The data bank does not identify physicians. There are no names, no addresses, no dates of birth, no social security numbers. But what you had was reporters who spent weeks or months. They already knew who they were looking at. They were filling in the blanks by talking to staff members at hospitals, by looking at court records, by calling different states to get their discipline files. And so they had so much information that they were able to take some of the records in the data bank and identify who the physicians were. But that's quite different than either manipulating a data bank or the data bank identifying the physician.
All right, Charles, fair enough. However, if the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration knew that the data bank was going to be a kind of Rosetta Stone for snooping reporters, maybe they never would have put it up there for public consumption to begin with.
I don't believe that's the case at all. It's clear that they knew exactly how it was being used, and in certain situations, they were even helping reporters on how to use the public use file to identify trends and identify outliers. And they took the legal interpretation that it wasn't a violation so long as the data bank itself did not identify those doctors, which it did not.
You know, there's a development here that kind of made me gasp. Not only did the Obama administration take down the data bank, it sent along a sharply worded letter to the Kansas City reporter informing him that he had subjected himself to civil penalties for abusing the data in the data bank.
It is mind-boggling. But beyond that, you know the precarious state of media organizations today, and many newspapers or TV stations would have gotten a letter like that and essentially killed the story. But to his credit, Alan Bavley and the Kansas City Star, they ran their story, and it really opened people's eyes. The government now says that they have no intention to fine him, which is great, but they shouldn't have threatened him in the first place.
Your organization, Association of Healthcare Journalists, itself sent out a letter to the Obama administration saying, in essence, what is up with that? What was the reply?
They essentially told us to, in nice words, take a hike. They told us that they were committed to the same level of transparency as we were, but they did not commit to putting this database back online. It seemed as if we were essentially ignored.
Since the initial exchange of correspondence, you've had more and more organizations take common cause with you. Is there any sense that the administration is going to reverse itself on this?
It's unlikely it will reverse itself. They say that they may put together some form of a public use file that could go online in 6 months or so, but it won't contain the same information. In the meantime, though, they're saying that reporters can submit a research request to the government, to this agency, explain what it is that they want to write about and what data fields they want, and the agency will determine the validity of the story and what data fields the reporter needs in order to write that story. That's pretty chilling.
Charles, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Charles Ornstein is president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists and a senior reporter for ProPublica.
This past Monday, 24-year-old Amanda Knox was freed from jail after an Italian court acquitted her and her former boyfriend of the 2007 murder of British student Meredith Kircher. Knox is American, but her case, crammed with tales of orgies and intrigue, all baseless, became an international story. The whole world was on the edge of its seat as the Italian judge stood to read the verdict. Would Amanda be acquitted, or would the guilty verdict and the 26-year sentence be upheld?
Amanda Knox is guilty of...
But the word guilty, someone at the English tabloid The Daily Mail hit publish on a story with this headline. Guilty. Amanda Knox looks stunned as appeal against murder conviction is rejected. But that guilty verdict was referring to the lesser charge of slander. Seconds later, the judge announced...
Amanda Knox and Raffaele Esposito are being freed.
Oops. Now, it's not uncommon for papers to prepare two articles in advance of a trial verdict, but the Daily Mail didn't simply misreport. It embellished, describing in detail Knox and her family's reaction to the verdict. Tim Ireland, a blogger for the Daily Mail Watch, which tracks the excesses of the tabloid, says many news organizations jumped at guilty and posted the wrong story, but the Daily Mail's blunder was a bridge too far.
Fair enough, they made a mistake. The BBC made a mistake. The Guardian made a mistake. The Sun newspaper made a mistake. But only the Daily Mail published an account of reactions and statements and events that could not have been witnessed as described.
Okay, so it was Nick Pisa, based in Italy, who did the story. You decided to have a little bit of fun with him. You wrote him an email that you posted online. How did the email read?
The email said, do you have any response to the evidence that you and the relevant Daily Mail staff were prepared to go to print with an entirely invented account of events, reactions and statements that you could not possibly have witnessed? And I included a little statement that I predicted he would make on the basis that he had predicted statements that other people would make.
You wrote, Mr. Pisa said, oh, do calm down. Everybody does it, in a clearly emotional tone before calling his critics names and running away.
Yes.
But he replied to you, didn't he?
He replied to me. And the funny thing was, he objected to me reporting that he had done this when I was obviously taking the mickey.
He took offense that you prepared his statement in advance.
Well, he took offense to the content in the statement that I prepared in advance, which completely missed the point that I'd made the statement in advance in a satirical manner. But then he behaved exactly as I predicted.
He called you a name?
He called me obsessive and then said, you better talk to the Daily Mail. Now, admittedly, his legs may not have been moving very quickly, but where I come from, saying, I'm not talking to you anymore, you want to go talk to these people, that's running away.
So, media portrayals of Knox have varied wildly. Sometimes she's a beautiful, naive, innocent young girl. Other times she's a sex-crazed killer. How have the British media depicted her, and specifically the Daily Mail?
Well, the Daily Mail offers their readers a combination of titillation and outrage. So to have a woman who's suspected of murder, and the theory is she murdered someone because an orgy was involved, well, that's perfect Daily Mail fodder. And I don't think Nick Pisa helped things when he attached the nickname Foxy Noxie to Amanda Knox and the story. Now, admittedly, Foxy Noxie was a nickname that Amanda Knox gave herself, but it was in the context of her ability as a soccer player to present it in the context of a hot piece of totty who's involved in a bit of murdering shenanigans and a bit of sex. It was not only entirely uncalled for, but the Daily Mail pretended that it was the nickname that the media assigned to her. The media generally, or people generally, people say, no, you say. You were the ones who brought it up. Take responsibility for it.
Now, journalism in the UK claims to be largely self-regulating. There's something called the Press Complaints Commission, the PCC, which is supposed to handle the regulation of the press.
Yes. The PCC is the self-regulating body for print media. One of the first rules in the guidance is if the article isn't about you, you can't make a complaint about it.
Really?
Yeah. The article has to be specifically about you.
Well, what about if you're complaining about substantial factual errors in the reporting of a government study or traffic patterns?
No, the PCC remit is so narrow as to be blatantly self-serving. There is a committee that makes judgments about what the guidelines should be, what the code of conduct should be. And the chair of that committee is the editor of the Daily Mail.
Uh-huh.
Public confidence in the PCC, I think I can fairly describe it as an all-time low.
Do you think that this Amanda Knox episode will have any lasting impact on the regulation of newspapers, or at least the public's opinion of these tabloids?
I think this incident is going to count as a major landmark, something that only really happens once every 6 to 12 months. Admittedly, it's been a very busy year, so I've had to say 6 to 12 months because I had to take Hackgate into account.
Yeah, that's the Murdoch tabloid scandal.
That's correct. But the public reaction to this was really quite extraordinary. We had 80 times as much traffic as we normally get as a result of this story.
Tim, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tim Ireland is a blogger for the Daily Mail Watch.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Rachel Meninja Brown is co-author with Sherrod Smith of a post-apocalyptic teen novel called Stranger. It's a popular genre, but the book can't find a publisher, they wrote recently in Publishers Weekly, because, they believe, one of their main characters wasn't, well, marketable. Seems like the nightmare of conformity that is high school has its analog in publishing. Brown gave me a brief plot summary.
Society has rebuilt itself as a series of scattered frontier towns, and a lot of people have mutations. We kind of thought of it as X-Men in the post-apocalyptic Wild West.
And it's told from the perspective of five characters. So who are they?
Five teenagers. Ross, who's the stranger who comes to town, and he has found a very precious book, which a lot of people are after. Mia Lee, who's a mechanical genius, who's very shy and quiet. Jenny, who is the teacher of the one-room schoolhouse, and she also has a second career in the town's military. Felicite, who's the daughter of the mayor, kind of a spoiled brat. And Yuki, who is not really from the town. He was rescued from a shipwreck of an aircraft carrier that came from Japan.
And Yuki is the character that was consistently unpopular with people that you are trying to sell this book to. One agent was particularly blunt.
Yes, we had an agent say that she really liked the book. She had one minor note, and then she would like to take it on. And her one minor note turned out to be that she did not want Yuki to be gay.
You and your co-author Sherrod Smith said thanks, but no thanks.
We actually got in kind of an argument about it. We explained why we felt that it was important to have gay characters in teenage novels, basically because a lot of teenagers are gay, and why shouldn't they have the opportunity to see people like themselves having post-apocalyptic adventures and romance like the straight characters do?
And this wasn't an isolated incident?
It turned out that it was not. A lot of people we spoke to had had similar encounters with agents or with editors who had asked them to change the sexual orientation of a character. After we wrote the article, an author, Melinda Lowe, ran an analysis of all the YA books released in the USA over the last 10 years, and she found that less than 1% had any gay or lesbian characters. And that's not just protagonists, that's even supporting characters. Less than 1%.
So you and Sherwood Smith co-wrote a piece in PW, Publishers Weekly, about what had happened to you, and you drew quite a response. There was somebody who wrote that an editor had taken it upon himself to change the sexual orientation of a gay character. The author put up a stink, and the character was reestablished as he was originally presented.
Yes, and that actually also happened with the racial identity of characters. Someone had a very similar story in which all the racial identifiers had been removed after the book had been sold.
Do you think that publishers and editors and agents are homophobic, or do you think that this is fundamentally a marketing decision?
I don't think they're homophobic in the sense of I hate gay people. Definitely not. But socially, we are a homophobic society, and that influences people's decisions, even if they are not personally homophobic. And yes, I do think they think it's marketing. But the fact is, books with gay characters don't get a big promotional push. Maybe if they did, some of them would succeed.
You made a conscious decision in this article not to name names, but don't you think that maybe some outing might be appropriate?
In this particular case, it's a bit of a moot point because the agency actually came forward of their own accord.
Uh-huh.
And said we were lying.
What?
Yeah. They said we were lying and it was a publicity stunt and they did not have that conversation with us.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is why people don't want to come forward, because they become the target of a lot of accusations. But the reason we didn't out them in the first place is because it's not about one agency. It's about a systemic problem in publishing.
After that agent hung up, Sherwood remarked about two supporting characters that seemed to go unnoticed.
Oh, yeah, that was funny. Well, so Yuki is the character who got all the attention because he's pretty major. But there's these two girls, Brisa and Becky, who are supporting characters. And they have a little romance going on in the background. After we hung up with the agent, we kind of looked at each other and Sherwood said, you know, they didn't mention Brisa and Becky. Do you think they somehow missed that they're a lesbian couple? Maybe they just think they're really good friends.
Rachel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rachel Manija Brown is a writer of nonfiction and fiction. Her book, co-written with Sherwood Smith, is called Stranger, Still Looking for a Publisher. You ever overhear two people talking about the end of a book you haven't finished or a TV show you haven't caught up on, and before you can plug your ears, the end's been spoiled for you? The good news, two professors at UC San Diego recently concluded that despite what you might expect, spoilers don't actually spoil our enjoyment of a story, at least in books. In fact, knowing the ending might make us like a story more. Wired contributor Jonah Lehrer wrote about the study. Jonah, welcome to OTM.
Thanks so much for having me.
This stuns me because my kids told me about the end of Fight Club and now I won't even go see it.
Well, what this study suggests is you'd enjoy Fight Club even more. This is a paper published by two researchers at the University of California at San Diego, and it was a very simple study. They basically gave several dozen undergrads a bunch of different thriller short stories, stuff by Agatha Christie, The Bet by Chekhov, stuff like that. And they gave the students these stories in three different conditions. The first condition was the story as is. So you're reading Agatha Christie as she wrote her mystery novella. The second condition was a spoiler artfully embedded in the first few pages of the narrative, as if Agatha Christie had given away the ending herself. The last condition was a spoiler which was very clearly set apart from the story. So it was in a different font at the very, very beginning. So it was clear that the scientists themselves had introduced this spoiler. And when you ask people which version of the story they enjoyed the most, people consistently, in every case but one, enjoyed the story the most when there was a spoiler first.
In every case but one.
The one exception was The Bet by Chekhov. And there I should point out that the difference was statistically insignificant.
How do they explain this?
There are a couple theories. One theory is that we think we really love big surprise endings, but it turns out that we like suspense, but we also like to have a general sense of how the story's going to end. And this makes lots of sense to me. When you look at the history of narratives and the history of entertainment, a lot of them are genres. The Hollywood happy ending, the Shakespearean tragedy and the Shakespearean comedy. When you read Pride and Prejudice, you're pretty sure it's going to end in a wedding. And so it's not as if you can spoil them for us. What's so alluring about the narrative is feeling the process. They argue that this applies to most narratives, that this isn't just a byproduct of short stories.
Do we know for a fact that knowing that Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's dad from the very beginning of Star Wars would make that movie more enjoyable?
You know, we've got this current obsession, I think, because of movies like The Sixth Sense and The Usual Suspects, with engineering that sudden, shocking twist. I think there are lots of filmmakers, my sense is, who believe that if you can pull that off, you can do anything. And I think what the study reminds us of is those kinds of sudden twists are profoundly overrated, that people don't actually like them very much. They're probably more fun to plan than to experience. And this really all reminds me of the famous distinction made by Alfred Hitchcock. He distinguished between surprises and suspense. He said surprises are cheap and easy. He said anyone can do a surprise. People don't enjoy it very much because there's lots of boring, tedious stuff, and then there's the surprising ending. He said suspense is really what people should aim for because you can have suspense even when you know how it's going to turn out. So he gives the example, people are playing poker at a card table, and the surprise is if there's a bomb under the table that the audience doesn't know about, and then 50 minutes of watching them playing poker, and the bomb goes off and they're all dead. That's surprise. Suspense is when you know the bomb's under the table, mm-hmm. you see the tick, tick, tick of the clock, then there's suspense. Then all of a sudden it's not 15 minutes of tedious poker playing, it's gripping entertainment.
You found this study very comforting, right? Because it helped you explain what you considered a character flaw.
Yes. You know, I mean, because I read the last five pages first, and I did this even for Harry Potter, which I'm ashamed to say, I always thought this revealed some kind of deep impatience on my part, that it really was a personality flaw. But now I know that I've got empirical support. I actually enjoy my Pulp Fiction more because I read the ending first.
Do you think that this study about spoilers has any implications for the writing of journalism?
What is a headline but a kind of spoiler? And I do think there's something comforting before you embark on, you know, an article that's thousands of words long. It's somehow reassuring to know where exactly you're headed. And I think a spoiler before an Agatha Christie short story works a bit in the same way. Total uncertainty. People don't actually like it very much. We don't want to know exactly what's going to happen, but we want to have some sense of where we're headed.
Jonah Lehrer is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. You can find his excellent science blog, The Frontal Cortex, on Wired's website. Jonah, say it with me. Rosebud was a sled.
Was a sled.
Apple Computer co-founder Steve Jobs died this week at the age of 56. Though Jobs' long battle with pancreatic cancer was well chronicled and his recent frailty much remarked upon, the announcement elicited gasps in the tech world and beyond. The computer pioneer, after all, was also a showman, famous for leading media audiences to think an event was at its end, only to bring the typically jaded press to its feet with a carefully planned and irresistible encore act. In 2007, we spoke with Wired Magazine blogger Peter Mortensen, who himself had just been swept up in the Jobs-staged introduction of the iPhone.
At about 9 in the morning, James Brown comes on with I Feel Good. The crowd sort of starts rumbling. There are gigantic video screens all over the place. The lights dim, and Steve Jobs emerges. People go nuts. And he goes into what his typical script for introducing products is. He talks a little bit about the success Apple has had, touches on existing products a little bit, and then starts heading toward new stuff. In particular, this time, there was the Apple TV, which was previously announced as the iTV last fall. It was expected. People knew about this. Then he stops silent, the screen fades, and an Apple logo inspired by the monolith from 2001 A Space Odyssey comes on the screen. I don't think they started playing Oslo Sprach Zarathustra, but it wouldn't have been out of place. And he says, "Welcome. We're going to make some history today." And everybody in the audience buys it. The people who are paying to be there and therefore have a greater vested stake in believing this, the people who are friends with Apple and just want to believe it, and the journalists who are there not to believe it. And he then says, "Apple has an amazing tradition of introducing truly revolutionary products. And today, we're going to introduce three such products.
Three
and there are gasps all over.
Revolutionary products of this class." The first one is a widescreen iPod with touch controls.
Second, a revolutionary new phone. And third, a breakthrough communications device for the internet.
And of course, it isn't three products, but in fact, it's one product.
And we are calling it iPhone. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
When the 2,000 journalists are standing there in the midst of this frenzy, what happens to their skepticism?
As soon as he held up the actual iPhone, it all dropped away, and everyone wanted one. It's embarrassing, but you can't help but feel sucked into it.
You actually write a column devoted to the whole idea that Apple isn't so much a company as a cult with a ticker symbol. How does a company achieve this status? Is it because they're masters of presentation or just because they consistently deliver the goods?
It's all of the above, and it's also a third piece, which is that they're massively secretive. So essentially, they tend to let journalists, pundits, and their fans do all of their PR for them.
In fairness, the iPod was a genuinely revolutionary product. So I guess the press could be forgiven for at least giving this guy a good listen.
And perhaps because they did underestimate the iPod when it was introduced. I remember in early 2001, Steve Jobs announced that he was going to bring forth a breakthrough digital device. And people got really excited. Was this going to be a teleportation box? You know, they were just going wild. And then he brought it out and it was an MP3 player. And not only was it an MP3 player, it was a $500 MP3 player. And the world just rolled its eyes. And 6 years later, it really has changed multiple industries. So I think there might be a little bit of a retroactive apology so that now people do buy completely into his hype because they underestimated him the last time.
Marketing strategist and author Peter Mortensen. And an appropriate eulogist he is, however, inadvertently, because Steve Jobs was himself deemed worthy of the marketing pantheon.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
That's from Apple's iconic 1984 Super Bowl ad titled 1984. By pitting a lone, iconoclastic woman against a hall full of slack-jawed drones in the thrall of a bellicose big brother, Apple announced its new Macintosh as a heroic choice. The IBM PC was hardware for the masses of brainwashed conformists, and the new Mac was a tool of liberation. The commercial, directed by Ridley Scott, was riveting and breathtaking. But more important was the extraordinarily enduring us-against-them message that helped coalesce a veritable cult. People didn't buy Apple products, they bought into the Apple ethos. Even as the enemy morphed from IBM to Microsoft and now increasingly Google, Apple wasn't just a company, it was a movement. Yet, though for 28 years in front of advertising audiences I've declared 1984 to be the greatest commercial ever made, it wasn't until recently that I understood its central genius. And that is, it was true. Not just shrewd, not just potent or emotionally true, but literally true. Sure, cunning marketers often play to the iconoclastic psychology of certain target audiences. Not hard to flatter random college students and graphic designers and hipsters as heroic subversives. But that's just marketing. Steve Jobs, it turns out, lived up to his advertised image. He was a bona fide revolutionary who, with the Mac, liberated his customers from DOS. Later, he would use digital technology not to speed up and cheapen cell animation, but to Pixar it into near irrelevance. Then, with the iPod, he consigned the recording industry and much of terrestrial radio into similar near oblivion. His iPhone revolutionized the handheld world, and his iPad is only just beginning to alter publishing on a grand scale. And with each such effort, he pried the thumb of some big brother-like monopolist off our slavish selves. He was Moses in a turtleneck, leading millions to deliverance. He didn't intuit our desires, he invented our desires. As he famously explained, it's not the consumer's job to know what they want. The consumer didn't know what she wanted, but she knew it when she saw it, and she used it, like the babe with the track and field hammer in the 1984 spot to send Big Brother up in smoke.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Boat, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer, with more help from Doug Anderson and Gianna Palmer, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.